From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. If you've been listening to this program for a while, you know that I am a rather reluctant convert to climate optimism. I really didn't want to be. As a journalist, I'd always chased after death and disaster. And that's what attracted me to climate science. I figured that being a climate scientist would give me the best possible vantage from which to watch the world burn. But over time, I began to see possibility in places I didn't expect. It seemed that everywhere I looked, there was somebody working to solve another piece of the program. In just about every interview I've conducted, I've heard scientists talk not just about hope, but also increasing confidence that hope might not be misplaced. But listen, if you want to put your climate optimism to the test, well, Jeff Goodell just might be your huckleberry. For more than two decades, Goodell has covered climate change for Rolling Stone, the New York Times Magazine, and many other publications. He's the author of multiple books on climate change and its effects, including most recently, The Heat Will Kill You First, which explores the profound threat of extreme temperatures and how those temperatures are reshaping the world and impacting human life, infrastructure, and the ecosystems that sustain everything else. And one of the things I appreciate about Goodell's work is that he's always been thoughtful about the fact that climate change won't come for each of us equally. And in a recent commentary in the New York Times, he emphasizes that heat is a predatory force, especially on those who don't have the privilege of retreating into air-conditioned offices in the middle of the afternoon. Jeff Goodell, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Jeff, you challenge me, but I don't want to set this up as a debate between a climate optimist and a climate pessimist, because you have said on many occasions that you do have hope, that you are inspired, and you think that we've been given an opportunity to build a better world. What do you mean by that?
I am an optimist. I mean, I write about the dangers and risks of climate change. And I think it's really important to understand what those dangers and risks and complexities are before we can really understand how to address this problem. Because I do think that however our value systems are, the physical facts of a warming climate are going to mean that we have to reinvent our worlds. We can change things for the better. And I think that this is a moment to do that.
Your point is that choices are going to be made either way, and having a clear-eyed view as early as possible determines how much choice we have in making those choices, yeah?
Right. That's a good way to think about it. I think you have to have a sense of what you're dealing with to be able to make smart decisions. And I think climate science is a tool to help us understand what we're dealing with.
As a journalist and an author, you've never been a punch puller, but I think that felt especially true when you began digging into the consequences of heat itself. And I'm wondering what your aha moment was there, your sort of like horrified aha moment, that when it came to global warming, which has all kinds of implications, it really was the warming, or the heating, as you often say, that threatens us most viscerally.
Yeah, I mean, my aha moment was very straightforward and very clear. And then it was on the streets of Phoenix in 2016. I was there on a very hot day, and I was late to a meeting. I was staying downtown, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to run. It's like 15 blocks, something like that, away. I'm just going to jog slowly to the meeting, and I'll be fine. And of course, it was 115 degrees in Phoenix that day. I was getting dizzy. I was like, my heart was pounding. I had to dash into a bank in order to like sit in the air conditioning for a minute. And I realized this is dangerous. And that was a profound awakening to me, because at that time, I had already been writing about climate change for 15 years, and it had never occurred to me that it could be actually dangerous to me. I was guilty of what a lot of us who think about climate change are guilty of, which is, you know, we write a lot about glaciers and their melting, or we write about the flooding in countries that are far away, but we forget about the intimacy of it and the fact that heat really is like a bug zapper. I mean, it can kill you very, very quickly.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because the thing that energy that's been trapped by greenhouse gases does first and foremost is that it warms the atmosphere. And then we jump right from that to all of the effects of that warming. Why is that? You say in your book, heat's invisible. Is that the central thing that it does? Or is it because we all kind of think we know what heat is?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I do think it's heat is invisible, and that I'm sitting in my office right now in Austin and I look out the window and I can't tell if it's 65 degrees or 115 degrees. Heat doesn't have a visual relationship for our brain. And another part of the problem is that for people who do pay attention to climate change, oh, there's a lot of talk about like 2 degrees of warming, and to a lot of people, and I included myself in this for a long time, the idea of like, well, 2 degrees of warming, what's the big deal? And it isn't until you think about it in these other dimensions and you realize what's really happening is that it's shifting around the atmospheric dynamics in ways that are making these extreme heat waves much more likely. Our bodies are extraordinarily sensitive to these changes in temperature. Many of us in hot places who are fortunate enough to be able to like read a book that I might write are, you know, probably well off enough to have air conditioning. And, you know, they think of this as just some problem for other people in other places. So there's a lot of mental barriers to really grasping what's at stake.
I don't think a lot of people realize this, and I think this is one of those mental barriers, that extreme heat already kills more people than all other natural disasters combined. And we can attribute many of those extra deaths to the extra warming that we have experienced over pre-industrial levels.
I mean, one of the problems with understanding heat deaths is it's very difficult. When someone dies of extreme heat, it's not like when someone dies of a gunshot. There isn't a marker like that. The fact is, we don't really know how many people die each year of extreme heat. These statistics are very poor in the developed world. When you look at places in the undeveloped world, we have no idea.
We had the climate population health researcher Tariq Binmarnia on the program a while back, and he made a similar point. We really only ascribe, you know, a few hundred to a few thousand deaths in the United States each year to heat, but it's this pressure that plays on all of these other health conditions. And when you line up the data in just the right way, it does become patent. But again, you have to just line up the data in just the right way. It's hard to see.
Yeah. And talking about heat death is only kind of one aspect of it. I mean, I think we all intuitively know that hot, extreme weather has other psychological impacts on us. I mean, for example, there's been a lot of new work on school test scores. You know, test scores go way down in schools that are unair-conditioned. I think we all know from our own experience that when it's hot, we get more irritable. And there's lots of studies showing rises in domestic violence during heat waves. So there's all kinds of kind of knock-on effects of heat beyond just, you know, does it kill you or not?
It is all but inevitable at this point that this will continue to get worse before it starts to get better, assuming it gets better at all. And this doesn't mean that we can't still work on mitigation. Of course, we have to keep working on mitigation, but we can't keep putting all of our eggs in the mitigation basket. We are going to have to adapt.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, hopefully this is sort of faded now, but you know, for a long time, there was a sense in the climate movement that we couldn't really have a frank talk about adaptation because that would take away from the energy and inertia of cutting emissions and moving to renewable energy. I think that was a very false dichotomy, and we absolutely have to talk about adaptation. And I think it's a very different dynamic. I live in Texas. We're seeing a huge clean energy boom here, even with all the Trump stuff. And it's not because Texas is run by tree huggers. It's because Texas is run by people who like to make money.
That's really interesting. I haven't thought about that before, that like there's really a lot of free market driving the movement toward clean energy. A very much avowed climate optimist, Chris Turner, makes that point all the time. But yeah, I mean, like the investments that we are making in adaptation are those that are hard to make a buck on today. And to the extent that those bucks will be made, they'll be realized 20 and 30 and 50 and 100 years out.
Right. And they're unglamorous things, right? They're not like the kind of things that are going to make you famous and rich. In general, these adaptation measures are really difficult. I mean, even something here in Texas has been an issue is the color of roofs. Lighter colored roofs reflect away heat and can lower cooling costs significantly. But there's tons of pushback against any kind of, you know, rules that would suggest that if I want a black roof, which I think looks cool, I can have my black roof. And so even small little changes like this get enormous pushback.
You have written about this as well in the wake of the heat wave a good 20-something years ago now in Paris that claimed something like 10 or 15,000 lives.
30.
Yeah. One of the reasons for that is that all over Paris, there are these buildings that have these zinc roofs. And in the wake of that, people said, well, maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. And that didn't go over well.
So these tin roofs in Paris are iconic. They are UNESCO World Heritage features of urban Paris, but they're death traps. The garret apartments that are beneath these are basically unlivable during summer conditions and were responsible for many of the deaths during the Paris heat wave that you talked about.
Just like feels like a very Parisian thing.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I will cook before I change what Paris looks like.
But that, you know, this I will cook before I do X is broadly what the fight about not only adaptation, but energy and in general. We like the way we do things. And so this sort of status quo inertia is sort of quiet, unspoken force in the climate fight that no one really talks about, but is a huge factor.
How much of a difference does it make, do you think, that we are getting so much better at seeing heat coming? And what I mean by this is that, you know, at one time, scientists were able to say, hey, you know, the globe is likely to warm by a certain number of degrees in a certain number of decades. And they were pretty much spot on right about that, by the way. But pinpointing how that heat was going to be distributed spatially and temporally wasn't possible. Today, increasingly it is. We can see it coming. What are we able to do with that information?
Ideally, what we should be able to do with that information is save lives, right? I mean, we should be able to say there's a heat wave coming, you know, take care. How we do this really well, of course, is with hurricanes. When a hurricane is coming, everyone knows where to go. We have nothing like that with heat. So as we get better at understanding these things coming, hopefully we will increasingly follow the sort of hurricane preparation idea and that we get people to be better prepared for these events. We've seen that in the extreme weather information. Damages from extreme weather have increased greatly in the last couple of decades, but the loss of lives has gone down. And that's because we're getting better at these sort of preparing for these incoming events.
One of the things we do know is that the effects will not be felt equally by all people. And you've written many times that one of the most important responsibilities that we have is to begin using what we know about what is coming to ensure that our world doesn't completely bifurcate into the cooled and the cooked. And I've got to say, by the way, this description, the cooled and cooked description, gave me these very distinct H.G. Wells Time Machine, Eloy and Morlock sort of vibe. Is it resonating with other people?
You know, yeah, I think that phrase is, you know, it's useful because it really does point to a bigger truth about all of this. I mean, I see it right here in Austin myself, looking out the window in my office, the roofers on the roof across the street, they're dealing with this extreme heat, their lives are at risk. And I'm sitting here in my office working on my book or something in an air-conditioned room. I mean, the line between them and me, even though they're only 30 feet from me, is a grand canyon of difference and of vulnerability. The way that climate change is going to affect my future and probably a lot of the listeners to this show is very different than the way it's going to affect the people who, for whatever reasons, have to make their living in this more vulnerable world where they do not have the protections that you and I and many of the listeners do have.
I think that's part and parcel to the fact that, as a study out of Duke University showed back in 2024, the share of both Republicans and Democrats from working class jobs who went on to hold seats in state legislatures is like 2%. There's, you know, the people making our decisions aren't the people who are most likely to be exposed in the ways that you're talking about. You've noted that a handful of states, California and Colorado, have passed laws to protect workers from extreme heat. But in Texas, where you live, there's not only no state level protections, but in 2023, Governor Abbott signed a law that prohibits cities and counties from requiring water breaks for outdoor workers.
Right, which is just barbaric, except when you put it in the context of a lot of the unbelievably barbaric things that are happening in our world right now. There's this fundamental sense of, you know, the powerful and the powerless. This is not just about water breaks for workers on hot days. It's about, you know, the worth of other human beings who are different than you. And so it really, you know, goes to this much deeper divide that we're seeing in our culture in America now.
I imagine that if Governor Abbott's kids or grandkids were playing a soccer game and the referee refused to adhere to local rules on when they deserve water breaks, he'd probably go nuts.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure, because they're his kids and, you know, he understands the vulnerability and the sort of empathy gap, shall we say, you know, doesn't exist there. But between Governor Abbott and the roofer across the street, you know, it's a Grand Canyon of a gap between them.
This forces workers into something that you've called extreme heart arbitrage. Basically, what we're talking about here are people gambling with their bodies because they need a paycheck, because they can't afford to say, no, this is wrong, and I need to take care of myself.
Yeah, extreme heat arbitrage, yes. You know, let's just take an example of your delivery truck driver, and you're doing a delivery in a hot city, and your truck doesn't have air conditioning, and you're dealing with extreme heat every day, all day on your job. Your choices are, you know, you can suck it up and hope you can get through the day and, you know, drink water and all that kind of thing. Or you can complain about it. And if you complain about it, you're going to be like, well, there are lots of other people who will do this job if you don't want to. And you're replaceable without any kind of legal or other kinds of protections. The tendency is to just keep at it. And in my book, I wrote about a farm worker in Oregon who died during this 2021 heat wave. And the night before he went to work, his mother called him and said, it's going to be hot tomorrow. Be careful. This is dangerous. He's like, yeah, I know. I'll be fine. And he went to work and he wasn't fine. He died. And the reason he died was because he knew that he needed to stay on the job, that if he asked for water and shade breaks, he would be fired. And he thought he was tough. He thought he was strong enough to get through it.
Yeah. In India right now, they're experimenting with insurance that pays people to come home when temperatures spike. That's a creative solution, probably not one that's scalable even in India, let alone the rest of the world. But I think it does represent some outside of the box thinking. How much of that sort of thinking are we going to need to apply to account for the ways in which heat is going to rearrange our world?
You know, when we talk about adaptation, we tend to think about infrastructure and things like that. This is a great example of how adaptation can simply be policy, right? It can just be thinking about a different kind of economic structure. And it's just a great example of how you can develop different kinds of policies that can save a lot of lives and don't require pouring of concrete or tearing off of roofs or re-insulating houses and things like that. And I would disagree with you. I think it is something that could be kind of expanded in all kinds of other industries and other places, maybe not exactly like this, but similar things that make it beneficial financially or otherwise for people to not expose themselves to these kinds of conditions. And certainly in work conditions, you can see how policies could be built that it's beneficial to the company and the workers, that they don't drop dead of heat on the factory floor or while they're driving their delivery truck or while they're working in fields. So I think it's a hugely inspiring and interesting point of a path forward that we haven't really thought about.
You ended the recent piece in the New York Times by saying that the comforts of some of us are being subsidized by the hardships of others. That's unfortunately not very unique to heat itself. It's a pretty fitting way of explaining the causes of consequences of climate change in general. And yet we keep on keeping on. What will it take, do you think, for enough of the privileged people in our world, the cooled as you call them, to wake up to the moral stakes of our comfort?
Well, you know, I think that's broadly the question that's being asked in America right now, and not just about climate, but about everything. What we saw in Minneapolis was tragedy, but also the response to it was incredibly inspiring. We saw people really rising up and saying, no, enough of this. And that's broadly the question you're asking here with climate and even more specifically, you know, with heat. And I think that one of the difficulties with the climate part of it is that effects are not like the tragedies in Minneapolis where it was all visible. It happened in a very dramatic way, captured on film. Everyone saw it. Everyone was outraged. One of the difficulties with climate and heat more generally is that it's slow.
Yeah, there's no bystander video.
You know, I mean, there are things like bigger hurricanes and, I mean, there are these extreme events. And during these extreme events, there's some political narrative getting built. There's this new branch of science called attribution science, where they're getting much better at saying in real time, this hurricane was made more intense by climate change, and we can show that. But it's a real challenge because it's different than other kinds of violence that have triggered political movements and outrage. And that's what we need. We need a political movement to be built around this. I mean, I think we're seeing progress on this, on the economic stuff. One of the places where we're seeing the most political action with climate right now is around home insurance prices. Insurance prices in California, in Hawaii, in many, many states are, pun intended, going through the roof. And a large part of the reason for that is, you know, increasing risks from climate change, from wildfires, from flooding, things like that. And that's driving a lot of political activity and sense of, okay, who's responsible for this? There's, in fact, a class action lawsuit that just got filed in Washington State by people whose insurance rates have gone up against fossil fuel companies to say, look, you know, you're essentially responsible for this wild escalation of our insurance price because you're selling the fuels that people are burning. You're making billions of dollars of profit off it. You have to help share for some of the costs of the consequences. And this class action suit, I think, has some real potential. And there's much more kind of rising action in that way. But with climate, it's just very difficult to make these connections in a way that builds sustained political inertia to deal with these difficult problems.
But it's growing, maybe a little bit invisibly like heat, but it is, you have a sense that it's growing, yeah?
Well, it's kind of hard to say that exactly right now when the Trump administration and, you know, by virtually every measure, climate has fallen off the map of sort of political concerns and political consciousness right now. But there's an inevitability to it. This is driven by science. You know, I mean, yes, we are going to come to terms with this and one way or another. It's just a question of, is it going to be the sort of Mad Max scenario, or is it going to be a scenario in which we use this moment of profound change to build a better world?
That's Jeff Goodell. He is a climate journalist and the author of many very good books on the causes and consequences of the climate crisis, the most recent being The Heat Will Kill You First. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was great to talk with you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Public radio stations around the country have had a substantial cut to funding, so now more than ever, it's important to support this work if you are able. You can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Maxim Dorian. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.